Hi, I'm Josh, and welcome to the Wild Nature Photography Podcast, the podcast that talks the art and craft of nature photography. It is the 2nd of March, 2024. This is podcast number 93, and the topic of today's podcast is going to be a big one. It's going to be, what are the questions you should ask, or perhaps what are the considerations that you should take into have front of mind when you are looking at joining a photography tour, a photography workshop, or a photography expedition? This is a podcast topic I've been asked to talk about quite a lot, and it's been a bit remiss that I haven't got to it before now, but it's a big, big topic. There's a lot to talk about. I had originally thought that I might do this as a bit of a top 10 questions list, but I decided when I was making some notes that there really wasn't sort of a top 10 series of questions to be asked, and having a top 10 kind of implies that one is more important than the other, and I don't believe that's necessarily the case. So I decided rather just to have sort of a more open discussion about it on my thoughts, having been doing this now for well over a decade, sort of circa 15 plus years now. I've been running workshops and expeditions for photographers around the world. So I've learned a thing or two about what works, what doesn't, and what are the questions that potential participants should be asking, or what should they be aware of, and what you should expect. So I think it's a big topic, and I think it's one worth talking about. It's something I've spoken about with other photography leaders over the years. Many of them, particularly the ones that I work with, have got very similar views to me on this. And so I think it's good to sort of summarize all the thoughts in a podcast. Just before I get to that, it is a rainy day here in Sweden at the moment. It is now just over a week or 8 days until I'm flying out of Sweden for Iceland, where I'll be for a couple of days before I head up to Greenland for my winter trip for ice landscapes, polar bears, other wildlife. I did say that I was going to talk a little bit more about that trip in the previous podcast, and I am very excited about it. Anytime you get to go to somewhere so exotic in the Arctic in winter, it really pushes my buttons. I get very, very excited about the possibilities and opportunities that can open up, because going to Greenland in winter and being out on dog sleds with local Inuit is an incredible opportunity for a wonderful experience, but also potentially for great wildlife encounters as well. And everything, of course, on an expedition such as this in winter is weather dependent. We are solely at the mercy of the weather. That determines what we can and cannot do. But it is my hope that we will be heading into Jamison Land to start with to try and find and photograph some muskox. Hopefully that will go well. Again, weather dependent, we'll see about that. And then we'll be heading out onto the sea ice in search of polar bears and icebergs that are frozen in place that hopefully we can use as background or landscape elements. And of course, there's other potential wildlife to be found there as well. Arctic fox, ptarmigan in their winter plumage. Ptarmigan in winter plumage is a beautiful bird. Love to photograph those. I actually had fantastic encounters with ptarmigan on my Arctic fox trip a couple of weeks ago. That was the first time I think we've had so many ptarmigan around the cabin there on such a regular basis. Anyway, looking forward to potentially some more ptarmigan photography. There's a potential for gyrfalcon, which is the world's largest falcon, a beautiful falcon that lives up in that part of the Arctic. So it's a very exciting time to be going up there. Of course, in March, it's going to be cold. You know, we're expecting temperatures perhaps as low as minus 40 degrees. Again, we'll just see how that goes. We have to take each day as it comes. But this sort of expedition just gives you an opportunity to create photographs that you cannot create any other way. There's no other way to get photographs of polar bears walking amongst icebergs than literally being out there on the sea ice with the polar bears. So especially if you want to photograph them at eye level, as I do. And I want all my participants to have that opportunity as well. So that's very exciting too. I'll be packing for that trip in the coming days. In terms of camera equipment, perhaps I should just talk about that for a minute. I'm going to take my two EOS R3s, and I'll take a couple of spare batteries for those. The 600mm f/4 will be my go-to lens for this expedition, and of course I'll take a 1.4 teleconverter. I'm going to take the Canon RF 100-500 for any close encounters, and that'll be mounted permanently on the second R3. And then I'll also take a 14-35mm. For any landscape, wide-angle landscape opportunities that might arise. And if I have space in the bag, which I probably will, I'll probably throw in a 24-105 just in case as well, because that's always handy to have. I'm not a fan of the mid-range zoom. It's not a lens I reach for a lot. I tend to pack it and carry it a lot and use it very, very little. But nevertheless, I think it will probably find its way into my bag just because it's nice to have and because I'm in Sweden at the moment and it's only one flight over to Iceland and up to Greenland. So relatively straightforward. Many people are not aware that you can fly to Greenland in winter. Yes, you can. Flights are not regular, of course, but they are available. So anyway, looking forward to that very, very much. I may try and squeeze in another podcast before I leave. Again, I'll just see how a little bit how I go with timing. As I said, I am still in Sweden at the moment, so hopefully I can squeeze something in. But let's come to the topic of the day, which, as I said, is choosing a – how do you choose the right workshop, the right tour, the right expedition when you made your mind up that you want to go somewhere in the world to photograph? I think it's a big question, and I think it's – quite honestly, I think it's one people make a decision on without enough thought a lot of the time, meaning perhaps it's better to have looked around a little bit more and thought a little bit more about who it was that you plan to go with before you go. Now, as a tour leader, I'll just use the word tour to summarize, but that obviously includes workshops and expeditions. I hear a lot of horror stories from people who've been on trips with other leaders where things have gone wrong. And I think the big question, the first thing you should ask whenever you're planning a trip somewhere with somebody is, have you been there before? And if so, how many times have you been there before? I think that's absolutely key. I think going with a workshop leader to a foreign destination where they haven't been before is really a recipe for a disappointing experience. You're far less likely to come away with a solid portfolio of work. You're far more likely to be following a leader around who's busy making their own photographs because they haven't been there before. And they're going to lack the local knowledge that you need to really get the best out of your investment. And that's a very, very key point. When you sign up for any tour, trip, workshop, whatever it might be, you really want to get the best return on your investment you can, meaning the best photographs out of that trip you possibly can. In order to get those, you're going to need local knowledge. Now, some photography leaders, myself included, often work with local guides in particular locations because we want that local knowledge and because that particular guide in that area has an intimate knowledge of the area we're going into and perhaps is better at arranging logistics or has the logistics arranged already. This is a very important consideration. It's totally okay, in my opinion, to go with any leader anywhere in the world if they have a local guide in that location that they know extremely well, who is first class, and if that tour leader, meaning the person you sign up with, has also been there at least once before. I think that's just so important. You do not want to be playing second fiddle to a tour leader who's busy making their own photographs and not willing to put their camera down to help you or is getting in the way of your photograph. And that's the biggest complaint I hear from photographers who've been with other tour leaders is they feel that, the tour leader they went with put their own photography first and put them a very, very distant second. You certainly don't want to have that experience. So ask, have you been there before? If so, how many times? And can I see a folio of your work from that location? Most photography leaders should have work from that location up on their website, and those photographs should inspire you because they should be the sort of photographs you're trying to achieve. If you're looking at another potential leader's work and you don't like it, then don't sign up with them to go on that trip because that's the sort of style of work you're probably going to come away with. You also need to be aware, very aware of how these trips are often marketed by other tour leaders. Recently, I had a very unpalatable experience where I found a very well-known photography leader in the US using one of my photographs to promote one of their trips to Mongolia. They will remain nameless for now. I contacted them. It was quite blatant. Their photograph was used on the front page of their tour. It was clearly my photograph. It had been taken from my website. I actually took the image from their website, loaded it into Lightroom, and it still had all my metadata in it, which was just unbelievable. But anyway, be aware of this sort of thing where people are using photographs that are not their own to market a tour to a location that perhaps they have never been or perhaps they've only been once or twice. This particular leader, when I contacted them, I gave them 24 hours to take it down before I said I would take further action. They did take it down. However, there was unfortunately no apology coming. It was pretty awful, really. It left a rather nasty taste in my mouth. But it's just something to be aware of. Just be on the lookout for photographs that are not taken by the tour leader that are used to market a particular tour, unless it's made obvious, unless it's disclosed. And I think disclosure is at the heart of the doing the right thing, if you like. I think it's totally fine to use a photograph that's taken by somebody else, provided it's disclosed and made clear, and that everybody understands that it wasn't the tour leader's photograph, but that they have permission to use it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's a very, very important thing to keep in mind. What photographs are used to market the tour? Were they taken by the tour leader? Because that is also the sort of photograph that you're probably going to get the opportunity to take, which is why you should sign up with someone or not sign up with someone based on what you think about the portfolio of work they've got from that location. That's probably enough on that topic. I could probably talk more about it, but I think that covers the main points on photographs. But look very closely at those. Often photographs can tell, obviously a picture tells 1,000 words, but it can be very useful to have a look at the environment that you're going into as well. Not just is the photograph art and do I like it, but have a look, are there photographs of the accommodations, etc. That sort of thing as well can be very useful. The next one is something that comes up a lot, and that is, can you accommodate dietary requirements? And it's very important, I think, to have a discussion about dietary requirements versus dietary preferences. So there is a very strong difference. Now, if you are allergic, if you're, for example, lactose intolerant or you can't eat seafood, all those sorts of things, your workshop or tour leader should be able to accommodate. You should be having a discussion with them about what those requirements are so that they can accommodate you at the other end and there's no surprises. Where it gets a little bit gray is when it comes into things like dietary preferences, because depending on the tour location or the location you might be visiting, preferences cannot always be accommodated. For example, on my upcoming Greenland trip, we're heading out with local Inuit on dog sleds. We're going to be camping on the sea ice for 7 days. We simply cannot accommodate dietary preferences on this sort of expedition, and I'm very clear about that. We can accommodate dietary requirements as long as we know about them well in advance. But dietary preferences, like, for example, I don't like sandwiches, simply cannot be accommodated when you're out on the sea ice and it's minus 40 degrees and you're busy photographing polar bears. So that's also something to keep in mind. That's why I think it's very clear to understand the difference between what is a tour, what is a workshop, and what is an expedition. Now, those three terms mean three very, very different things, but they're not always used in the correct manner by many photography leaders. Now, on a photography tour, you really shouldn't expect anything in the way of instruction. I think a tour is really about dragging participants around from location to location and providing them literally a take me to my potential photograph opportunity, and they can then go and make some photographs in that location, and then you move on to the next area. That's a tour. Usually a tour will include some explanation of the area that you might be visiting. So it might say, we're going to visit this particular waterfall in Vik, in Iceland. This waterfall is called X. It was first photographed back in the X days, etc. That kind of historical information is often included in a tour. But usually tours don't include any photographic instruction. And usually on a tour, you can be pretty sure that the accommodations are going to be satisfactory for most people. Meaning you're not likely to be put in a tent unless it's very specifically a tenting tour. So I think that's very important. On a workshop, I think anything that's called a workshop, I think you have an expectation that that comes with a certain level of teaching, or at least an offer of that level of teaching. So if you're going on a photography workshop to Iceland, for example, I think it's fair to assume that your photography leader is going to be there and available to help you if you require it. It doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to gather everybody into a circle and say, let's all learn about filters now while we stand in front of this beautiful waterfall and watch the good light. It doesn't necessarily mean that, but it does mean that your leader should be available to you when you need them, if you require assistance in the field. And this is a key one and a big one. Your leader has to be willing and able and want to put their camera down to help you first. And I think that's a big factor that a lot of leaders fall down on, because they get too caught up in their own photographs to help others that are around them. And that's really ultimately what we are there for, is if we're calling it a workshop, we're there to help other people. And we need to put our own cameras down and be willing to help other people. And this is something I talk about when I do my introductions on pretty much all my trips, is I make it very clear that I am more than happy to put my camera down the second somebody needs help. And I will do so no matter what the situation. Even if there is a polar bear in perfect light coming straight towards me, I will put my camera down and I will help you get your photograph, because that's what you're there for. And that's what I'm being paid for to do as well. That's my job, is to help other people. But you need to communicate. That's the other side to this coin. It's no good saying, hey, Josh, 3 weeks later, sending me an email, hey, Josh, I wish you'd help me out with that polar bear. All my images are soft. that's too late. The horse has bolted. The time to do so is in the field. And a good workshop leader will certainly put their camera down and help you at any time. That's a workshop. Now, a workshop also might include image critique sessions. It could include information on image post-production as well. Every trip will be a little bit different there depending on what that trip might be. I know some tour leaders and trip leaders, they like to run critique sessions every day. And I know that there are participants that do and don't like that. Not everybody is comfortable showing their photographs that they've shot from the day at the end of the day. And I appreciate and understand that a lot. I tend not to run critique sessions in groups. I tend to run them in one-on-one. I think one-on-one is far more valuable than a group session. Group sessions can be interesting in that you get to see what other people have done, but it really only has any benefit if those other people are voluntarily sharing their photographs with you. If they're being forced to share three or four photographs every day because that's what the workshop leader demands, I don't think there's any real benefit in that. I think people are then just throwing three or four images in because they're required to. Whereas if you're doing a group session where everyone is voluntarily bringing images along and there's back and forth positive critique and discussion, that can be beneficial. But I've found over the years that the most beneficial critique comes from one-on-one. And it's far better for me to sit down one-on-one with someone during a trip or after a trip and have a discussion about the work and what can they do to improve it or what should they have done, what are my thoughts on the images. So that's worth keeping in mind as well. And that brings me to expeditions. So we've got photography tours, photography workshops, and then photography expeditions. Now, on expeditions, generally there is not much time for critique. Because you're out in a tent, you're out in the field, and generally it's difficult to do critique, and perhaps it's even difficult to download for images at that particular time. Of course, it's going to vary a lot depending on where you are and what that expedition might be. For example, on the recent Antarctic expedition I did, I took 50 people down to Antarctica on a ship in December of 2023 last year. And because we were based on a large ship, we had time for me to do a very extensive image processing lecture and to do a lot of critique one-on-one with people as well. So on some expeditions, it's possible to do that. On others, less so. But on an expedition, I think and I feel strongly that it's incumbent on the leader to make the most of the time that they have for the group in the field. So making smart choices about how time is spent, the places that are visited, when to put Zodiacs in the water, when not to put Zodiacs in the water, when to make shore landings, all these kind of decisions that are made by the workshop leader or expedition leader are critical to the end result that you may have or on that particular trip. So there's a very important difference to understand between workshops, tours and expeditions. Expeditions may have time for photographic instruction in the field. Quite often they do. And again, I always make myself available to everyone who's on a trip with me and make them aware that they come first from a photographic perspective. I will always get out of the way if I'm in somebody's way when I'm taking a photograph. And I'll also always try and help somebody get a better photograph. So if I see them doing something that I think is less than ideal or less than optimal, and that perhaps if they move location, it's going to be a much better image, I'll obviously put down my camera and help them do that. And that's a key factor as well. Something else to think about, and again, it's going to depend on whether you're attending a tour, a workshop, or an expedition, is can you have a single room, and is there a single supplement if you're a single traveler? Now, of course, not everybody is, but many photographers are, and I think that's why it's an important question to ask early on. Is it possible to have a single room? It's always nice to have a single room if you're traveling alone. Everybody prefers it, so I would always ask that question. And I think not much more needs to be said on that. Another one that's a big question to keep in mind and to ask is this trip dedicated to photography or are there general tourists also joining us? Now, this generally applies to larger expeditions to Antarctica and the Arctic on bigger ships. Many tour leaders out there or photography leaders will get together with other companies that run expeditions to these locations for general tourists and will take a small group with them, but you end up being a very small group of photographers on a general tourist trip. and provides a less than optimal experience. I've been there, I've done that, I've had that experience. It's not great. It's far better to be on a trip that is dedicated to photography because you're going to be able to work when the light is at its best. You're not going to be dragged back aboard the boat because the chef wants to serve dinner time. I have done in the past an extensive guide on this. I think it was specifically around Antarctica, but the same thing actually applies in the Arctic. I may actually try and link to that in the show notes. I think it's a useful guide to have a look at on how to choose an expedition to Antarctica and things to be aware of. And the big one is this trip dedicated to photography and photographers, or are you sharing with general tourists on board the trip? Because that, in my experience, does not work very well. It's less than optimal. Bring me back around to the photographs that the tour leader or the photography leader is using to market their trip. I think it's very important for them to be genuine and upfront about those images. Are those images single image captures from the field, or are they multi-image composites that were done in Photoshop? Because if that's the case and that's not disclosed, I think that's very disingenuous towards the participant. You're, as a participant, I think, and I've been a participant on many workshops and expeditions myself. I still try and do a paid trip myself every year so that I can see what other people are doing. But as a participant, I think we have an expectation when we look at the leader's photographs that that is what we are going to be able to achieve, or at least that is what we're striving to achieve. If an image is a multi-image composite and it's not disclosed, you have no hope of ever achieving that image if you don't know that that's the technique that was used, that it was actually assembled in Photoshop after the fact. Now, as a nature photographer, I don't do that. I don't do that kind of multi-image composite work. I find it disingenuous when it's used to market tours, workshops, and expeditions, especially. I just don't like it. And I think it's incumbent upon the leader to be open with their potential participants that this photograph was made in Photoshop. Yes, the source materials were captured from that location, but it wasn't done in a single image capture. It was done in Photoshop using multiple photographs, perhaps one from sunrise and one from sunset, whatever the case may be. But that's something that's worth talking about as well. Are they real captures or are they heavily manipulated images? And it might not matter to you, by the way. I'm not saying there's a right and wrong to this. I'm simply saying that you should be aware which one is it. Because if they're heavily manipulated composite images, that might work in just fine with your style of imagery. It might be what you do. That's totally okay. I'm not downplaying that at all. I'm just simply saying that I think it's good to be aware of that. How many participants in the group? This is another big one. I think it's very, most tour leaders are very good at this. Most photography leaders get this right, and that they are upfront about how many people they are going to be included in the group, and that is the maximum limit that will be included in the group. It's not nice to find out that you thought you were going to be one of six, but actually you find out you're one of 12 because the tour leader sold too many places or never intended to keep the minimum to six, whatever that might be. So that's a good question to ask. If it's not disclosed, as I said, quite often it is disclosed, and I think that's a very good thing. Just on that, you can also ask about spouses and partners. Are they welcome on the trip? If you're wanting to travel with a spouse or a partner, or are others bringing spouses or partners? Sometimes a spouse or a partner might only want to come on a trip if there's someone else is also bringing their spouse or partner so that they have an opportunity to discuss something perhaps other than photography. So that's worth some thought as well. Then we come to the issue of travel logistics and transfers. And again, this is a big one. I think it's incumbent on the organizer to help each participant with logistics and with travel. And I'm not just talking about recommended equipment or what lenses should you bring, or should you bring filters or a tripod. Excuse me. I'm talking about whether they can assist you with information on flights. When should you plan to arrive before the trip begins? When should you plan to leave? What is the best airline to get there? What's the ideal route? What do they recommend based on their experience with the different airlines in getting to that location? Because realistically, your experience on any trip begins from the moment you sign up until the moment you get back home and complete the trip. So therefore, the logistics are just as important as the actual trip itself. And in many ways, the logistics play a large part in the success of the trip, and certainly how you feel mentally when you arrive on location, having just traveled perhaps from the other side of the world. So there's a lot to be considered when it comes to travel logistics. And I think it's completely fine to reach out to your trip leader
and ask them for help on this. Not necessarily to ask them to book travel on your behalf, because most trip leaders, particularly photography leaders, they're not travel agents. But many of them out there in the field, myself included, have a lot of experience with international travel. And we have some strong thoughts and impressions on what airlines work well to get to a given location, when you should arrive, how many days you should allow extra in case of lost luggage or delays at both ends of the trip, both at the start and at the end of the trip. So it's worth asking about help with travel logistics and transfers, as well as recommended packing lists for things like clothing, not just camera equipment, but ancillary equipment as well. You know, do you need a sleeping bag, for example, if it's an expedition, or is it being provided for you? These sort of questions. Headlamps is another one. Do you need a headlamp? If you're coming to the Arctic, do you need ice spikes? All that kind of information. And then it's about setting expectations. So the trip leader should be setting expectations for you more or less from the moment information starts to be sent out to help you prepare for a trip. And by setting expectations, I mean making you aware of what to expect when you get to the final location where you're going to be based for the photography, assuming you're based in one location and not moving around. I'll give you a great example of this. The trip I run for Arctic foxes up in the far north of Iceland in the Hornstrandir Nature Reserve, I am very clear in all my documentation that the cabin that we use to stay in this part of the reserve is rustic. It's basic. It has everything that we need as a home away from home, if you like, but it's heated by wood. It doesn't have enough rooms that everybody can have a private room. It has one bathroom for sharing. And it's very important to be upfront and clear so that people know what to expect. They're not expecting to arrive in the Hornstrandir Nature Reserve in the far north of Iceland in winter into a five-star hotel, because that's not what it is. It's a small cabin. It's the only cabin in this particular location, so it's the only place we have to stay. And we have to be prepared to get a little bit rustic in order to get the photographs that we want. And that's an important thing to communicate as the tour leader, so that people know when they arrive what to expect. And if you set the expectation correctly, then no one's going to be disappointed on arrival, and everyone's going to have known what to expect and be ready to work in the field with what they've got. I do hear a lot of stories from clients who've come on a trip with me, and they've talked about other trips they've done with other leaders where they've said, oh, this was awful. Went to this location, they promised X, Y, and Z. I got there and it was only Z, and I wouldn't go with them again. Well, that's the fault of the tour leader. Not necessarily that the accommodation was bad, but simply that they didn't set the expectation properly of what to expect when you get there. That's so important, I find. Once an expectation is set, people know what they're going to discover when they get to the other end. Usually, no one has a problem with it at that point in time. The old saying of under promise and over deliver is key in this area, in my experience. Let's talk about shift gears slightly. Let's talk about understanding what it is that you might want to get out of a trip that you've signed up for. Is it teaching? Is it experience? Is it a inverted commas take me to my photograph? Are you looking for critique? Are you looking for help with your workflow, with your processing? Be clear on what it is that you want to get out of a trip and communicate your needs and wants, I think, with your tour leader. That's going to mean that you get the most value out of what it is that you're going to do. Because if you don't communicate what it is you want, tour leaders are not mind readers. We have many superpowers, but mind reading is not one of them. But if you communicate with us what it is that you want to get out of a trip, we can help you maximize that, and you can then walk away having got the best out of it. Because everybody comes on a trip with different expectations of what they want to get out of it. I've got clients who are phenomenal photographers, and they simply have an attitude of take me to my photograph, meaning, Josh, I want to go to Greenland. I want to go there in winter. I want you to get me out on the ice so that I can photograph. I know what I'm doing. I just want to photograph the polar bear against the blue iceberg. Fantastic. I know what I'm dealing with there. Very, very easy. Then you're going to have other people who are going to say, I want to have that same experience, but I need help with my camera in the field. So that's important to communicate, so that the tour leader knows that you are going to require a little bit more assistance in the field, and they can be around to help you with that. So understand what it is you want to get out of the trip as well. Then we've got a very thorny issue of work permits. So this is a very gray area that, in many ways, the whole tour business in photography. And it's very important to make sure that wherever you are going in the world, with whatever leader you are going with, that they have the required permits. This is something I have run into a lot, particularly in places like the South Island of New Zealand, where I'm seeing or have seen many photography leaders and going down there with groups without the required national parks passes, without the required work permits, and trying to fly under the radar. This is fraught with danger, both basically because eventually they are going to get caught. And I know of several that have been caught in the South Island of New Zealand and several that have also been caught in Iceland and have been shut down on the spot. Vehicles impounded, and that was it. That was the end of the trip because they didn't have the required permit to be working in the field in a remote country, or they had not employed a local guide and using their business for the trip. So that's a very important consideration as well. You should certainly ask that question, and I think you're well within your right to ask that question of any potential photography leader in any foreign country. Do they have the required work permits to be there? Because the last thing you want to have happen is to have your trip cut short because they were trying to fly under the radar. It doesn't happen a lot, but it's something to be aware of. Understand any fitness level requirements, and you should ask about this as well. All trips have different levels of fitness requirements, and everyone has a different level of fitness. Again, this is just a communication issue. If you discuss this with your tour leader via email, they can tell you either that you're suitable for the trip or that you're not. And it's important to be honest about your fitness level. It's something none of us want to really disclose, if you like, because I don't think any of us are as fit as we really want to be, but we need to be honest about our fitness level so that the workshop or tour leader can accommodate it or be upfront and say, hey, this trip is not for you and this is why. And it's not a personal thing. It's simply that, hey, we're going to be at altitude of 15,000 feet. It involves a lot of steep hiking and this trip isn't for you because physically you're just not up to it. You would hold the group back. That's an okay thing to say. It's better to be upfront and say that than it is to say, nay, hey, no problem. You can come on the trip anyway. And then that person ends up being a problem for everybody else who's signed up on the trip because they can't keep up. So understanding your fitness level requirements is very important. And having a discussion with your leader about that is also very important. We talked about packing lists and recommended equipment. I've talked about, can you bring a spouse or a partner? And we've talked also about understanding the difference between a photo tour, a workshop and an expedition. And I think just to sum up, the last thing I wanted to talk about is, I think, post-trip follow-up. Many leaders out there, once they're done with the trip and the trip is finished, that's it, they're done. There is very little in the way of follow-up. I think it's very important to follow up. I always like to send an email at the end of the trip inviting people to submit a photograph or two if they need help with post-production or if they want to make a print. I'll always make a print for them out of my own time and out of my own pocket. You only pay for some freight to freight the print back, wherever that might be in the world. And also for feedback as well. It's important to ask for feedback. And feedback is very important from both perspectives. So post-trip follow-up, I think, is also really, really important. As I said, this is a topic I've been asked to talk about a lot. I've got quite strong thoughts on it, having been doing this now for, as I said, 15 or more years. I have learned a lot about expectations. I have learned a lot about understanding the difference between tours, workshops, and expeditions. I have learned a lot about managing expectations. And these are all things that need to be taken into consideration when you're choosing a potential trip. Of course, you never know who else is going to be signed up on a trip, but you can always ask. If you know that there's going to be six people on the trip, hey, is the trip full yet? Who else is going? Maybe there's someone else going that I know. Of course, we have to manage the privacy aspect of this, but as the tour leader, that's incumbent on us to manage that at our end. So I think that pretty much sums up my thoughts on photography tours, workshops, expeditions, and what are the questions you should ask as a participant? What are the things you should look out for and be aware of? And though all of you, if you follow that advice, I believe that you'll have a great experience and that you will get the most value that you possibly can out of any trip you have signed up for. And that's really the key. You want to get value. You want to get the most out of it you can, because if you are flying around the world to a far-flung destination, you want to make sure that you maximize your investment and really get, not only obviously everybody wants a great portfolio of work, but you also want to have a great experience at the end of the day. That's so important too, because these are life experiences. And for many people, these destinations might be places that they're only going to visit once in their life. So it's important to get it right. So that's my thoughts. Let me know what you think on this. If you've got some thoughts as well, you can, of course, drop me an email and let me know what you think. A reminder, too, if you want to support the show, you can buy me a coffee. There's a link to that in the show notes as well. I will try, and just simply because it costs me about $25 a month to run the podcast in hosting fees, etc. So all contributions there are greatly accepted. I will also try and lost my train of thought now for a second, what I was going to do. Oh, I'll try and put a link in the show notes as well to that guide I wrote on choosing an expedition to Antarctica. I've had a few emails from people actually asking me over the last month now when I'm going to run my next ship-based expedition to the peninsula. The short answer is I'm not sure. I am still trying to find the right ship to make that happen. Polar Pioneer, which I used in December, is wonderful. I would love to use Polar Pioneer again. I'm not sure if it's going to be available in 2026 and beyond as yet. I'm just waiting to hear on that. I've also got some feelers out for some other vessels as well, so we'll see what happens there. It's very important to get the right ship for these expeditions. It is at the crux of getting everybody into the best locations at the best time. So I don't want to put on a trip to Antarctica just for the sake of it. It's really got to be at the right time of the year on the right vessel. But I'll keep you posted. I'll have more to say on that and more as we go forward. As I said, I'm off to Iceland and then Greenland in 8 days from now. So my head is starting to turn towards preparing for that because it is an expedition. We are going to be out in the field, and it does require a bit more thought about packing as well. So I think that's it for today. It's still raining here in Sweden. It's been raining all week. That's just how it goes, I guess, in the spring thaw. I'm Josh. It has been the 2nd of March, 2024, podcast number 93. Look forward to seeing you out in the field. Take care.